It's the 26th of July 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is PRISM eliciting a full spectrum of opinions? Is material science predicated on a solid foundation? Why are women cyclists told, on your bike? And how would you improve the game of chess, given its checkered history? But before we begin, not the traditional begging slot, an untraditional begging slot, because I, your humble host, am looking for work. That's right, I need something to do during the day. The Pod Delusion I do at night, and it's lovely and fun, but there's no money in it. So if you'd like to employ me in London, go to the Pod Delusion website, follow the links to my CV, and possibly decide to pay me to do things for you, as that's how employment works. As you might expect, I'm an excellent team player, I'm good at problem solving, and all of those other boring CV cliches. And I'm also quite good at digital stuff, media stuff, podcasty stuff, this sort of thing. Just go and have a look at poddelusion.co.uk, and please employ me. Please? And now, the actual traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us pay the server bills and, well, who knows, maybe buy food in a few months' time. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with the ongoing PRISM scandal. We've all heard that they are watching everyone, but who are they? What are they doing? How are they doing it? And what can be done? Here to answer all of those questions is none other than Kate Russell. She's on the telly every week, so presumably she's used to people watching her.
You have zero privacy anyway. Get over it. So said Scott McNeely, CEO of Sun Microsystems, about privacy in the digital age back in 1999. At the time, his comment caused outrage and indignation. I wonder if anyone would be so surprised today. A few weeks ago, a prism was a transparent object used for splitting light into a spectrum. Ask most netizens today what the word evokes, and I'm willing to bet the NSA comes pretty high on the list. For those who've been living under a stone inside a box at the bottom of the ocean for the past 2 months, here's a massively compressed zip of the story so far. On the 6th of June 2013, The Guardian and The Washington Post broke what will probably go down in history as one of the most important tech stories of the 21st century, publishing what they claimed were top-secret documents revealing a huge clandestine data mining operation by the US National Security Agency, NSA. The accusations came from Edward Snowden, an ex-agency employee, initially through two key leaked documents: a copy of a secret court order allowing the NSA to collect and keep telephone records from millions of US citizens arbitrarily and without warrant or request, and a PowerPoint deck describing an intelligence program called PRISM, which appears to tap into the internet traffic of some of the world's biggest tech companies, including Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and Facebook, collecting data such as audio and video chats, photographs, emails, documents and the like, all without anyone's permission. Since then, further leaks published by The Guardian on the 21st of June implicate the UK government's own security agency, GCHQ, in a similar long-term snooping programme codenamed Tempora. According to reports, this programme has been operational since 2011, which means that all the while we were fighting the controversial draft communications bill in the public domain last year, our government was just collecting the data it wanted anyway. Am I alone in feeling cheated on by democracy here? Since then, the PRISM saga has run and run, with countless comments and opinions being threaded into a web of paranoia and deceit, nourished with a drip feed of ongoing exclusives from Glenn Greenwald, the reporter Snowden first approached to break the story. Snowden himself, at the time of recording, is hiding out in a Moscow airport, an international fugitive branded a traitor by some and a hero by others. I'm not going to go into all the claims and counterclaims in detail here, partly because it changes daily, and if I'm honest, partly because I don't have time to verify all the reports myself, and I can't really afford to fund a Crown Court defence right now. I've put links to a lot of articles on my website if you want to read up on the details yourself, which I'll ask James to link in the show notes. Or you can just put Prism Scandal into any internet search engine, although maybe choosing Google would be a tad insensitive. In the end, I had to stop obsessively cutting and pasting every story I came across into a master research document, as I was in danger of needing a Utah data centre to store it all in. For me, one of the most plausible explanations of where this story is rooted came from Steve Gibson in his twit.tv podcast, Security Now, episode 408. This is a series which is definitely worth subscribing to if you want weekly updates, although they can get pretty technically hardcore at times. It explains how data could be siphoned off the internet using optical splitting technology placed on the fibre optic cables just upstream from the servers of the companies targeted, in other words, Google and Microsoft and the like. These splitters could slice off a band of light, allowing the NSA to collect their own copy of whatever traffic was flowing through the cable. And this theory has since been further validated with another leaked slide from Snowden. In the podcast, Steve even links to a legal declaration recorded in May 2006 in which an AT&T telecoms employee called Mark Klein talks about being privy to exactly this kind of technology, apparently being deployed in secret rooms at the telecom exchange by the NSA. As Steve Gibson points out, this hypothesis could make sense of the name Prism too, and would give us some leeway to believe the major tech companies when they claim to be innocent of any complicity. Although recent leaks about Microsoft and Skype handing over encrypted messages and voice traffic to the NSA since as far back as 2011 make it harder not to get the impression that this lack of culpability is only paper deep. At least for some. I must point out, though, for balance, that these reports are so far very one-sided. Microsoft has said publicly that it wants to clear up the details of these damning leaks, but the NSA has put a gag on them. In the past few days, reports have surfaced that 17 of the world's largest tech companies, including Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Facebook and Twitter, have sent a letter to the NSA, the Attorney General Eric Holder and President Obama, demanding transparency from the US government over the user data requests that they have made. So, that's the backstory, roughly speaking, and now for the million-dollar questions. Do we really need to worry about it? And if we do, is there anything we can do anyway? I've frequently heard supporters of government surveillance programs say, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to worry about. Foreign Secretary William Hague repeated this same mantra in a BBC interview not long after the Prism story broke. Now, call me old-fashioned, perhaps a little bit paranoid, but that assertion is so far wide of the truth, it's in danger of leaving our solar system. Let's start with the collection of phone records. It's been noted time and again in arguments both for and against these spurious activities that no actual conversations are recorded. The agency just collects the metadata, such as which numbers were connected, for how long, and in the case of mobile communications, where the callers were located. It's information your phone company keeps for billing purposes anyway, and would readily be handed over in the event of a court order. So, what's all the fuss about? Well, the phone company only keeps this data for a limited amount of time, after which it's deleted from the server. By siphoning off this information and keeping it in perpetuity, the NSA is building a historic map of connections, in which every call, no matter how long or the reason it was made, is logged and stored in a huge data centre out in the Utah desert. This facility is built to store 5 zettabytes of data, enough space to record the entire daily traffic of the internet for 5,000 days. With this map, the NSA can travel back through time, tracking connections through a spiny web of digital filaments, leading away from anyone who becomes the target of an investigation. The data collected from internet traffic can be used in a similar way, building a digital map of your life and connections, even if you take the time to encrypt communications so they cannot actually be read by an intercepting party. If you carry a mobile phone with you, many of them constantly ping the network to confirm they're switched on and operational. It's possible that even this data could be collected, recording a physical map of the places you've visited, regardless of whether or not you make any phone calls there. Again, I hear you ask, why should this worry me if I'm behaving myself? Paranoid? Much? Now, I don't recall ever having done anything I should worry about in terms of national security or criminal activity, although I will admit to once having cheated in a maths test. But working on the 6 degrees of separation theory, and the fact that I'm a tech journalist who regularly searches the web for news about online crime and such like, I wonder how long it would take to connect me to some really bad people if you looked hard enough. Even a wrong number could land you in serious shtick 20 years from now, and it would boil down to your word against the metadata's. I'd almost prefer them to be recording the call, as at least then there would be some context to refer to. I've heard surveillance supporters expound that the chances of this mistaken identity happening are so small as to be negligible, 1 in 1 billion. After all, it's not like the US government would willfully misuse this data, is it? Well, just read up on Nixon's enemy lists as exposed during the Watergate scandal and J. Edgar Hoover's well-known antics of using surreptitiously harvested data to harass political dissenters and activists to learn the truth about that. Even if the only mistakes that get made are rare and truly genuine, it terrifies me to think that we might have sleptwalked into a society where it's okay to throw the odd innocent under the bus in the name of national security. What if it was you, or your child? It's not going to feel quite so 1 in 1 billion then, is it? American cryptologist Bruce Schneier summed up the situation we now find ourselves in a prophetic article published back in March 2013, titled "The Internet is a Surveillance State," which is highly worth reading if you get the chance. In it he said, "So we are done. Welcome to a world where Google knows exactly what sort of porn you like, and more about your interests than your spouse does. Welcome to a world where your cell phone knows exactly where you are all of the time. Welcome to the end of private conversations, because increasingly your conversations are conducted by email, text, or social networking sites. Welcome to an internet without privacy, and we've ended up here with hardly a fight." So, that's the why should we worry, and now, what about the what can we do? Well, there are some practical measures we can all take, although with every layer of security comes another layer of inconvenience, so I imagine startlingly few internet users will actually bother to adopt them. I've put links to a good selection of resources on my website if you do want to protect yourself, not just from government spooks, but the legitimately bad guys too, if you'll pardon the oxymoron. Many of these tools use encryption technologies, so that any data transmitted over the internet is scrambled and only decipherable if you have the key. It's also worth noting that ongoing leaks suggest that the very act of encrypting your data or using privacy tools automatically puts you under suspicion from the NSA, and they will pay extra attention to collecting and cracking your comms if you flit across their radar. Encrypting your internet traffic will stop people spying on what you're saying without the use of some fairly heavy-duty cryptology tools or some pretty heavy-handed subpoenas. But it won't stop them collecting your metadata, I'm afraid. When it comes to internet snooping, the Cat5 cable is well and truly out of the bag, and there's pretty much nothing we can do about it if the government is intent on knowing our business. If by some miracle you do find a secret squirrel hole, enjoy it while it lasts, because as soon as it becomes popular enough to register on the authorities' radars, you can bet your connection they will use the sledgehammer of regulation to force a back door into the system. We shouldn't be surprised. As Bruce Schneier's article points out, we've done it to ourselves. At least Faust gave up his soul for unlimited knowledge and worldly pleasures. We've done it for the sake of unified logins and an online shopping basket. Go us. This has been Kate Russell dumping another couple of thousand bytes of voice data into the Utah desert and showing up like a beacon on the NSA's radar for the pod delusion.
Now, Dara O'Brien's Science Club was back on our TV screens last night, and last weekend, one of the show's stars, Mark Miodovnik, spoke at the Winchester Science Festival. We were there, and rather than chat about the glamorous yet facile world of show business, we instead had a quick chat about his day job, being a material scientist. Are you a presenter of Science Club, or are you a sort of a pundit or an expert?
I'm the resident demo expert and general dog's body.
Excellent. You've been speaking at Winchester Science Festival today, and you're a material scientist. So let's start really basically. What does a material scientist actually do?
Well, we study the stuff that everything's made of, which is everything, right? Everything's made of something. And that makes the subject extremely wide-ranging. And it means that you have to understand about physics and chemistry, but also biology, and also fashion, design, architecture, because that's it's basically, you know, everything from buildings to molecules. And so it's a huge subject.
One of the first slides in your presentation was fascinating. It was just a normal photo of London, but you pointed out all of these different materials, and it really does make you think how it all came about. And you said the thing that resonated was, I think you said something like each material was a revolution almost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at, just look around you now, and you know, let's say you spot some rubber tires on a car. Well, you know, without rubber, you know, our journeys would be a hell of a lot more bumpy. And actually, the first bicycles didn't have rubber tires and were called bone shakers for that reason. And you can't imagine the bicycle taking off without that material, and neither the car either. So actually, that is revolutionary in rubber. Well, who cares about rubber? But actually, probably most people walk around with rubber soles on their shoes, and actually, it gives them, literally gives them a spring in their step. So, and that's just one material, and I could just point to 100 in this room and tell you a similar story. But we take it for granted, and that's a shame.
We're talking of bone shakers. One of the other things in your talk was the, was it called bioglass that was used in bones. I'm not a scientist, and it completely blew my mind to see that this already exists.
Yeah.
Would you be able to tell us a bit about what it is and how it works?
There's a type of glass called bioglass, and it's made in a way that's like a foam. So it's a hollow structure which is all connected with holes. And when you implant that into the body, the surface chemistry means that the cells, the stem cells that sit on it, they like it, they prosper on it, and they turn into bone cells. And that's just an amazing thought, isn't it? But as they progress into the material through the holes in the material, they build up a layer of bone and then a solid piece of bone, your own bone. And after a few years, they are just your own bone. So you regrow your own bone in your body. And it's in clinical use now.
And is this still new? Is it a widely known thing?
Or? It was developed in the 1960s as a result of the Vietnam War by a guy called Larry Hench, and it's taken this long really to get to the point where it's a routine introduction into minor surgery. It hasn't got to the point where you can replace someone's whole femur, let's say, or whole hip with it, and that's because it takes a long time for that bone to grow, and in between times it's not very strong and you can't walk around on it. So it works very well for bits like a cheekbone where it's not going to be under huge stress at the moment, and we need to find a way of using it to make the bigger bone structures.
And what would you say, what's the next thing for material sciences? What's the next big thing? Another thing you showed was the windpipe, I guess, that was artificial.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the next big thing is very hard to say materials because it's such a wide subject. And you have graphene in the electronics area and lightweight materials, and then you have, you know, self-healing concrete. You know, so there's so much going on in the subject. But in terms of body implants, I think what are called scaffolding materials, so bioglass is an example of it, I think are going to be very big because I think they might be the key to growing people's own kidneys and own livers and maybe own hearts out of their own cells. And therefore the whole of the industry around having to find a donor may just go in 20 years time, and that's really exciting.
It all sounds incredible. I'll let you get back to the festival, but do you want to give your book a quick plug?
Yeah. Well, I just wrote a book called Stuff Matters, and I talk about all these things in the book, and it's really about the stuff that everything's made of and where it's come from and where it's going.
Brilliant. We'll put links to that on the Pod Delusion website. Mark, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Staying with Winchester Science Festival, and one of the other people speaking there last weekend was Deborah Skeen, a professor of neuroendocrinology. which is an actual thing and not just a long word. Deborah's work is concerned with circadian rhythms and the science of sleep. Her talk was dead interesting, so didn't send anyone drifting off, but if they had done, she probably could have told you why. Liz started by asking Deborah to explain more about what she does.
My name's Deborah Skeen, and I study circadian rhythms at the University of Surrey.
So just for people who obviously weren't at the talk, what was your talk on today?
So it was about clocks, body clocks, and the human circadian timing system, because our main research is to study humans and what the clocks do.
Cool. And it was absolutely fascinating that I came in slightly late, but that basically you need light, you need to have sight in order to have a proper circadian rhythm.
Yeah, at least you need sight and light to entrain and keep your clock and your circadian system synchronized to the world we live in, the 24-hour world that we live in. Cool. Otherwise, it would be like living in a cave.
And I think this was mentioned early on, that our actual natural rhythm isn't quite 24 hours. That seems very odd with like how evolution happens, that we have sort of a 24 hours. Or is that affected because it changes very by season? Do we know why this is?
You're right in that we need the flexibility. We can't be fixed exactly at 24, because then we'd have no flexibility for changing seasons, for different parts of different latitudes, mm-hmm. A changing dawn and dusk time. So with the flexibility, we're able to each day just correct slightly to maintain entrainment. So it's absolutely perfect not to be exactly 24.
Given that in our latitude or longitude or whatever, we have very long winter or dark periods in winter and stuff, but what about things like people who live in the Arctic? Have there been any studies on them and like how messed up their sleep must be?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult. As you know, there are not a lot of people who live there. A professor at the University of Surrey did work in the Antarctica, but this was on the British Antarctic Survey base. And of course there, you still take your environment with you. So you still have heating and you have lighting in the base where they live. So although the photoperiod changes so much in the Arctic Circle, naturally living people are few and far between, but it's an absolutely relevant question. Of course, the Scandinavian areas have changes in sleep in winter and summer, and have, for example, quite high incidences of seasonal affective disorder, which is likely related to the light environment. As you're losing that daylight, one has a tendency to be more depressed, and we know that light as treatment with light boxes can help that. So you have to do your artificial light for that.
What I found absolutely kind of blew my mind was the non-visual photoreceptors. When was that discovered? And oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, so that was from 2000. So we've had 10, 12 years of it. It was fascinating because nobody predicted the colour, the sort of 480 nanometer blue colour of it. People suspected humans might be responsive to green because we were brought up in the jungle or leaves and why it's blue. The human work, the study in healthy volunteers, was going on at the same time as a lot of important animal and cell culture work. And the discovery of the photopigment, melanopsin, was key. And then the fact that where the melanopsin is in the retina, that these cells are photosensitive, directly photosensitive, because this was very exciting, meaning that light directly at that level sends signals through. So it has been a whole kind of revolution, and it has good basis now for us to start designing and thinking about lighting and our environment if we want to start influencing the biological effects of light.
And you were mentioning to as someone who was asking a question before about light boxes and that sort of thing, and I was always slightly skeptical of them, that they couldn't possibly be a thing, but they really do work.
Yeah, I mean, you have to know about when you want to give the light and what you're doing it for, you know. But the sort of very simple message is always you need light in the day, and often in winter and in our offices, we don't see a lot of light. So get out, walk around at lunchtime, get lots of light, and you don't need light at night. So try and have dark bedrooms, don't, you know, have a lot of things that involve light-emitting instruments late at night, because that could delay your sleep.
So turn off the laptops, the phones.
Yeah, yeah.
I found it absolutely fascinating. You're doing, I guess, a study, but more or less a study and a project with the elderly in your area with light, red and blue light to affect sleeping patterns. How long has that been going on? How long is it going to run for?
We finished the field study part of that, but we were testing out two different formats of light, one that has more blue in the light than the other one, and essentially just putting these lights into the communal areas of care homes and then asking the residents how they felt each week. And this was a 12-week study, so we're currently analyzing the data on that. This study was done in the winter because, again, that's when our light levels are low, so it's in process, but these data sets take ages to analyze. It's the
it was really interesting that you can take melatonin to shift your kind of peak melatonin cycle. When was this discovered? Because
right.
I like vaguely had an idea, but like that seems a fairly profound thing.
Yes, so the first studies really were done at the University of Surrey in jet lag, and the prediction from the animal work, which was 1983 science paper, suggested that by manipulating when you give melatonin, you could shift the clock. And more and more well-controlled, with more people, studies have happened. So we definitely know if you take melatonin in the evening, you will advance the timing of the clock. And that can be useful for people who have delayed sleep.
Do we know how things like, because it's very useful for things like insomnia, but how is insomnia genetic, or is it something that could be kind of environmentally, like you start staying up really late, so therefore you keep staying up really late and then you kind of develop at that? But what are the mechanics of things like that?
Yeah, I just would want to stop and say we can't use the word insomnia because there's so many different types of insomnia. Coming back to, if we're talking about where your sleep timing is not normal, so it's later than most people, and we want that reflects possibly a delayed clock timing, and we want to try and get that right, then melatonin will work because it will move and advance the clock back to a good position. It's not, melatonin isn't a sleeping drug, and it's not good, you know, you can't say melatonin is useful for insomnia as a blank statement. It's when it involves that the clock is in the wrong place, it means your sleep is in the wrong place, and you need to bring that all back to the right place.
And so if you don't sleep at all, that's a completely different
thing.
It
is, and that can be psychology, it could be you have breathing problems, you have restless legs, there's endless amounts of sleep disorders and insomnia that have nothing to do with the clock.
Oh wow.
So
your talk was absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for talking with me. Deborah Skeen, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Now, a new drug recently came to market making a number of claims, and it all sounds rather proper and correct. But actually, is it? This week, Adam Jacobs and Hayley Johnson have been digging deeper to uncover the truth.
Simvastatin, hydrochlorothiazide, losartan, amlodipine. If I asked you to classify things as either conventional medicine or quackery, which would you choose? I'm guessing you chose conventional medicine, right? Simvastatin is a well-established drug for treating high cholesterol, and the other three are all well-established drugs for treating high blood pressure. However, everything depends on context. A website has recently been set up to sell a combination of those four drugs as a single pill, the so-called polypill. You can find it at polypill.com. The idea is that the combination of drugs helps to reduce blood pressure and cholesterol, which in turn reduces the risk of heart attack or stroke. The company marketing the polypill claimed that it can reduce your risk of heart attack or stroke by two-thirds, and that it's suitable for most people over the age of 50 who don't already have heart disease. This isn't necessarily a completely crazy idea. We know that the components of the polypill can reduce cardiovascular risk in some patients. Maybe putting them all together can reduce cardiovascular risk even more. Maybe they reduce it so much that they reduce it significantly, even for people who are not at particularly high risk in the first place. But you'll notice that there are a lot of maybes there. The claims for the polypill are based on statistical modelling of the effects we'd expect from the combination treatment, based on what we know about the effects of the four individual components. That modelling makes some heroic assumptions, chiefly that the risk reductions of the various components of the pill are additive, and that the risk reductions would apply to those initially at low risk as much as to those at high risk. Although the polypill concept was first published in a paper in the British Medical Journal about 10 years ago, the assumptions underlying the claims about the polypill remain largely untested. The polypill website reports a clinical trial which looked at short-term effects on blood pressure and cholesterol in 86 patients, so we do at least know that the polypill can reduce blood pressure and cholesterol over a period of 12 weeks in highly selected patients, but I don't think that was ever in doubt. What is noticeably lacking is any data on cardiovascular outcomes, such as heart attack or stroke. We simply do not know the extent to which the polypill reduces cardiovascular risk. And this, dear listener, is why I believe we're looking at quackery here. Although the components of the polypill are indeed conventional drugs with a good evidence base in appropriate patients, the combination product is being sold on the basis of dramatic but unsubstantiated claims. That is the stuff of quackery. What also looks like quackery is that the polypill is an unlicensed medicine. Although the individual components are well-known drugs, available as licensed medicines, the combination is not licensed. It's important to realise that specific formulations of medicines are what get licensed. If two licensed drugs are combined in a new formulation, then that new formulation has to be licensed in its own right. The polypill is not licensed. It's interesting to read a quote from Professor Nicholas Wald, one of the people marketing the polypill. "You need randomised trials that demonstrate efficacy and safety for each component and in combination. It's so difficult that for practical purposes it's impossible." Does that claim about it being too difficult to do randomised trials sound familiar? Many alternative medicine practitioners, such as homeopaths, also like to claim that the reason they don't have randomised trials supporting their products is that they're too difficult. Now, to be fair, it is difficult to do a randomised trial looking at cardiovascular outcomes. You typically need to recruit many thousands of patients and follow them up for several years. However, it's not impossible, and many such trials have been done. But given that the trial has not been done, there's no excuse for making claims about the polypill as if it had. Again, the stuff of quackery. And not only do we not know the extent to which the polypill reduces cardiovascular risk, the fact that it hasn't been tested in long-term clinical trials means that we also lack information about its safety. This lack of information on the risk-benefit ratio is of particular concern for people who aren't at high cardiovascular risk, exactly the people at whom the polypill is being marketed. Those at high cardiovascular risk may well already be receiving treatment within the normal system of conventional medicine. For those at low risk of a heart attack in the first place, then even if the polypill results in a substantial reduction in their relative risk, the reduction in their absolute risk will be tiny. The risk of side effects, unless it's truly negligible, may well then outweigh any benefits. But this does not stop the marketers telling people that the polypill will benefit them and selling it to them anyway. Again, quackery. Now, I'm a medical statistician, so I know a thing or two about things like relative and absolute risks. But to better understand some of the practicalities of giving drugs like the polypill, what we really need is a pharmacist. Luckily, I happen to have one handy. So here's Hayley Johnson to give you a pharmacist's perspective on the polypill.
Practically speaking, the polypill is an attractive idea. As originally envisaged, it was going to be a public health measure used in a whole population to reduce the risk of heart attacks and stroke en masse, which sounds great. And of course, swallowing tablets isn't the most pleasant thing in the world to do, and having to only take one tablet instead of four sounds marvellous. Or is it? The first to consider is whether a patient would actually need all of the components, or would need to take it at all. If, as originally intended, the polypill is given to everyone in a certain population, it is inevitable that it would be given to some people who don't need it. And what if their blood pressure and cholesterol would have been perfectly well controlled on none, one, two, or three of the components? Then we're exposing the patient to a drug for no reason at all, and that of course isn't a no-risk option, as it carries the risk of side effects and drug interactions, etc. Secondly, will anyone actually take it? Given the way it's being sold as an unlicensed medicine not available in the NHS, there's no way that the whole population that it was intended for will have access to it. And even if someone does start taking it, how likely are they to keep buying it? Remember, the people who it's aimed at have nothing actually wrong with them. And would you remember to take a pill every morning for no obvious gain to yourself? And would you still remember to take it if it were to cost you a whopping £88 every 12 weeks? Who are the sort of people who are likely to go on the internet and seek it out? It's likely to be people who are already engaged with their healthcare, those with disposable income and an awareness of what is good for their health. So they're already likely to have less of a risk of cardiovascular disease anyway. Thirdly, what if a patient suffers an adverse reaction? Adam has already mentioned about how the unlicensed nature of this product means that we don't know that much about its side effect profile yet. When you're taking separate tablets, it can be easier to identify which drug is causing the problem and to take action accordingly, so maybe reducing the dose or discontinuing it if required. But how do you do that if you're taking a polypill which has a number of drugs all lumped into one? It becomes a lot more complicated. And anyway, can we justify giving somebody with nothing wrong with them a range of drugs that might cause some side effects? The fact is that right now we just don't know if the benefit versus risk balance for the sort of people who will be buying the polypill is worth it, nor are we likely to find out if the manufacturers haven't done the trials needed to get it a license. Conversely, what if the doses contained within the polypill are too small to give a benefit to some people? Again, with single fixed dose formulation, you lose all the flexibility that you need to get optimal doses for different patients. I tried filling in a free online consultation to see the sort of questions that patients are being asked, and they seem pretty vague. Things like, do you have any serious health problems or conditions that you think we should know about? And it also seems pretty obvious which answers you need to give to be approved to buy the polypill. As a pharmacist, I would want a lot more information from a patient before even selling them a cold remedy over the counter in a pharmacy. And I've learned over the years that you need to be very clever with the types of questioning to get patients to answer honestly and freely. If I were to ask, for example, are there any serious health problems you think I should know about over a pharmacy counter, I'm pretty sure that some patients wouldn't think to mention things like asthma or high blood pressure, because an individual's definition of serious can vary. So it would seem that the online consultation isn't quite as robust as it should or could be to ensure that only patients who could benefit from and safely use the product can buy it. Then there is also the question of whether the way the polypill is being advertised is legal. A fellow pharmacist, Dr. Anthony Cox, has written a really great summary of why he believes that the advertising may be illegal on his blog, which you can find a link to in the show notes. But here's a brief outline of the issues that he raises. Advertising of medicines in the UK is controlled by statutory regulations enforced by the MHRA, as well as the system of self-regulation by the pharmaceutical industry. There isn't any direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription-only medicines in the UK, so the only medicines that can be advertised to the public are those that you can buy over-the-counter in a pharmacy or general sales list medicines, such as the ones that you can buy from a garage or off supermarket shelves. The polypill is an unlicensed prescription-only medicine being produced by a specials manufacturer. Specials manufacturers have to hold a specials license from the MHRA, and that means that they can make unlicensed medicines providing certain conditions are met. Specials manufacturers are more commonly used in cases where an individual patient has a particular special need that cannot be met by a licensed formulation. So for example, where a patient cannot swallow a tablet and needs a liquid preparation, but there is no licensed liquid preparation on the market. A special product may not be advertised. The MHRA regulations state that it is in breach of the regulations to issue any promotional material for a licensable medicine until the license has been granted. Specials products may not be supplied if an equivalent licensed product is available which could meet the patient's needs. In the case of polypill, there is an argument to say that in actual fact there are equivalent licensed products in existence, i.e. the four individual licensed components. The MHRA regulations make it clear that websites aimed at the UK audience, or even just material posted on a UK website, are subject to the UK medicines advertising legislation. And remember, the Polypill website is advertising an unlicensed prescription-only product directly to the public. So whilst I do think that the Polypill might be a useful concept for some patients, I, like Adam and others, have some reservations with the way the Polypill is being sold. Drug regulation is there for a reason, to protect members of the public, and trying to circumnavigate the regulations just because it's too hard to get a licence for a drug doesn't to me seem like the ideal way to be going about things.
There's a further disturbing aspect to the Polypill. Before you can buy the Polypill, you need to have it prescribed by a doctor. The Polypill website offers an online consultation with one of their own doctors. Now, there's probably much to say about the appropriateness of prescribing medication based on an online consultation, and Hayley's already touched on that, but I'll leave it there for now. No, what I want to talk about is the conflict of interest. Just think about this for a moment. You have a doctor whose professional responsibility is to prescribe the most appropriate treatment for their patient, but who is paid by a company selling a drug to prescribe that specific drug. Just imagine the hue and cry that would ensue if a company like GlaxoSmithKline or Pfizer were caught doing that. I can't understand how this can be compatible with the General Medical Council's rules about conflicts of interest for doctors. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the Polypill is a bad idea. It's an interesting idea, which is certainly worthy of study. What I am saying is that to market the Polypill to the general public with impressive sounding but unsubstantiated claims before it's been properly studied is pure quackery. This has been Adam Jacobs and Hayley Johnson for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you heard last week's show, that you'll have heard that apparently golf isn't very progressive on the sexism front. Unfortunately, it turns out that this isn't an isolated case, as cycling also has a lot of work to do. It sounds like they really need to make improvements. Maybe I should put a brake on these puns. Makes me more employable, doesn't it? Here's Emma Shields to explain more.
With Chris Froome taking the top prize at the centennial edition of the Tour de France last weekend, the second British cyclist in as many years after the successes of Sir Bradley Wiggins, the profile of cycling in the UK is still perched atop the crest of a Sky Pro Cycling-led post-Olympic cycling binge. But as this intense love affair with cycling continues, there are rumblings from a long underrepresented group of cycling malcontents, namely women. Many other sports have worked to equalise pay and performance between male and female professional athletes. For example, the Women's Tennis Association, founded by Billie Jean King, recently celebrated its 40th anniversary. Its formation was a determined effort to get women's tennis recognised as equally deserving of respect, support and prize money. This action included exhibition matches between male and female athletes and is the subject of the recent documentary Battle of the Sexes. The world of cycling, however, still trails. Professional cycling is regulated by the International Cycling Union, also known as the UCI, and in 2011, its current president, Pat McCade, was quoted as saying that women's cycling was, quote, not developed enough, end quote, and largely dismissed calls for a minimum wage for professional female cyclists. This is something that male cyclists have been entitled to for a number of years. Like many involved in political circles, he and those who agreed with him at the time, including the president of British Cycling, Brian Cookson, are currently backpedalling from this sentiment as the latest election campaign gets underway. On the 14th of January 2013, when British Olympian Nicole Cook announced her retirement from professional cycling at the age of 29, in a lengthy statement to the press, she made much of her disappointment at how women's cycling is still perceived, despite the efforts made by herself and many others. She also pointed out the lack of support for women keen to make a career for themselves in cycling. At the time, she was praised for her forthright views on this entrenched sexism, but in the intervening months, this message seems to have been largely forgotten. There is still no minimum wage for professional female cyclists, and as such, teams are still under no obligation to make sure their riders are paid. In her retirement address, Nicole Cook talked anecdotally of a rider leaving the sport as her team failed to pay her. Like many other people, these women have families and financial obligations, and the UCI has been failing them. But even when there's positive support for female cyclists, there are female versions of a number of the big races in the cycling calendar. For example, the Giro Rosa is the current female version of the Giro d'Italia. For men, this is a 3-week race, as the name suggests, around Italy. For women, this race is a fraction of the length, at little over a week long, despite being the biggest race of the year for these cyclists. As a result of this and a general lack of sponsorship, the prize purse for these races is a fraction of the prize money available to male riders. The race itself also went largely unpublicised, as it was scheduled to run during the first week of the Tour de France. And despite the presence of such races, there is a glaring omission. For male professional cyclists, the Tour de France is massive. It's the biggest race of the year. The biggest teams and the best cyclists in the world spend in excess of 80 hours racing around France over the course of 3 weeks in a spectacular test of endurance, stamina and mental toughness. Coverage of this race dominates the French press for the duration, with sponsors falling over themselves to get a piece of the action. There is, however, currently no Tour de France for women. Between 1984 and 2009, there was a poorly funded and gradually shrinking race held in France that was generally considered the women's version of the Tour de France. But the race was scrapped in 2009 and has not been replaced. At one point, the race was 15 days of racing, over 2 weeks long, but by 2009 this had dwindled to a mere 4 days as funding for a UK-based start and 3 stage races fell through. This led the eventual winner of this particular incarnation of the Tour, British cyclist Emma Pulley, to comment that their grande boucle, pardon my French, had become the petite boucle, pardon my French some more. Female cyclists have found themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place, as without races, there is little incentive for sponsors to invest in teams and indeed races. But without sponsorship, there is little incentive for race organisers to commit to women's cycling. In a move aimed to tip the balance and help raise the profile of women's professional cycling, a number of high-profile female athletes, including the aforementioned Emma Pulley, former Ironman triathlon world champion Chrissy Wellington, and the current women's road race champion Mariana Voss, have put their names to a petition addressed to the organisers of the Tour de France, calling for them to organise a Tour de France for female cyclists. You can find a link to this petition in the show notes. The petition asks that the Amaury Sports Organisation, the organisers responsible for the Tour de France, help support an incarnation of the Tour for female athletes. They're not asking that the race be a distinct entity, like the female versions of a number of current races, but that the stages of this version of the Tour run on the same days and the same courses as the men. With 2 races a day for 3 weeks over the same course, this means more racing for spectators to view. And so the argument goes, how can this be bad for sponsors? And how difficult can it really be to manage the infrastructure required when it is already in place for the men's race? This is a format already used for the Tour Series, a series of city races held in the UK, where there is a parallel women's race on the same courses on the same days, known as the Johnson Health Tech GP Series. This seems to work fine and can be just as popular as the men's race. The deputy leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman, has also added her voice to those of the dissenters. With the grand part of the 2014 Tour de France leaving from Yorkshire and travelling through Cambridge and London on its way to the French capital, she has made it clear she believes that this is a, quote, great opportunity to hold a women's event and set an example to the rest of Europe, end quote. Another of the names behind this petition is the American athlete and journalist Catherine Bertin, who has recently completed filming for a documentary entitled Half the Road, and she is currently working to bring this feature to screens. In a paraphrase of the Maoist adage that women hold up half the sky, itself a reference to the importance of women in society, she hopes to argue in her film that female cyclists deserve half the road, referring to opportunity, funding and support. Funding for this has largely been sought through crowdsourcing, something that the documentaries filmed and broadcast after the successes of Sir Bradley Wiggins and the downfall of Lance Armstrong will have never had to contend with. While unlikely to achieve its lofty aims straight off the bat, these women are working hard to demonstrate that they are not any less able than men when it comes to feats of sporting endeavour. At the risk of sounding a little didactic, if the success of our female athletes at the Olympics taught us anything, it should be that they deserve better than to be sidelined in this way and given every chance to show the world what they can do. This is Emma Shields advocating sporting gender equality for the Pod Delusion.
Now this week, Salim Fadley has been speaking to the man who's currently working on a sequel to a classic game. No, I'm not talking about Half-Life 2, but chess. Personally, I suspect making such a sequel is going to be polarising, a black and white issue. Personally, I'm looking forward to a feminist version of chess, where you have to get your opponent to check their privilege.
Some video game sequels are worth waiting for. 7 years after Nintendo gave us Zelda: A Link to the Past, we finally got Ocarina of Time, but those 7 years pale into insignificance compared to the millennia which have elapsed since the invention of the game of chess and its new sequel, Chess 2. I spoke with Zach Burns, the founder of Ludmere Games, who's working on the first computer implementation of Chess 2. I began by asking Zach to explain just what's wrong with the original game. After all, it survived for hundreds, possibly thousands of years.
The idea of reform in chess is not a new one, right? Historically, the game has been evolving to change according to the needs of the players at the time, right? But at some point, we stopped. And as a result, we've kind of been pushing up against the limits of the game for a while now. The oldest example of this that I can think of is world chess champion Emmanuel Lasker, who over 100 years ago was starting to predict the problems that we're having with the game today. So, what are these problems, right? Why have they predicted this? And chess is a game that we would like to be about analytical thinking, right? But instead, the game, because it's been so deeply studied at this point, has become about memorization instead of improvisation or positional play. This is especially true in the opening of the game, where high-level players will memorize books and books of just rote openings and what other people have already done instead of inventing. The second problem comes partly from the first, and that because the paths of chess have been so well-trodden, that 60% of the games among top 20 players right now are ending in a draw. And that's just because the game has been so studied that everyone is playing what is well known to be a balanced game, and then it never goes into an interesting endgame and ends up in a draw most of the time.
These seem like utterly intractable problems, but how would you go about fixing these problems with this ancient game?
Right, well, the game designer, David Serlin, has solved these problems, I think. And he did this by drawing, of course, from chess's history and from many variations that have been done over the years. But he also added some very interesting key insights of his own in a way that preserves the flavor of the original game. So let's talk about fixing draws first. The way that he approached this was to add a secondary and new win condition in addition to checkmate. So you can win by checkmate or by this new thing called midline invasion. And the way that midline invasion works is that if your king crosses over the midline of the board into enemy territory, then that's a win. So I think this is interesting because it has the same flavor as chess, where the checkmate condition in chess is ultimately constricting him, confining him. And midline invasion is about demonstrating to your opponent that you have an ultimate freedom, right? That you won't be restricted, that you can move across the board in the way that you choose. So in this way, like checkmate and midline invasion are actually two sides of the same coin. And then the next problem, of course, that's to be fixed is the problem of memorization. So the way that Serlin approaches this was to introduce six armies to the game, which players choose from secretly at the beginning. And there can be 21 possible matchups, right? If you choose one of six and then I choose one of six, there's 21 different ways that the game can start from there.
So by army, you mean you can choose a slightly different rule set for one side or the other. So I could be playing normal chess rules, and you could be fighting against me playing a slightly different set of rules. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So let me give you a quick example of this. One of them is the empowered army, and I like this army. So if like a knight and a bishop are next to each other, then the knight can move as a bishop, and the bishop can move as a knight. But to compensate for this power, your queen only moves as a king. right? So that might be one of the things that you would choose if you think you're good at openings and you're good at making your pieces well coordinated. These are your strengths, and you might choose this army to play to your strengths. So the way that this helps is that it's really hard to memorize an opening book when you don't actually know how the game is going to begin, right? You don't know what army your opponent is going to choose. And no one that I know of is able to memorize an opening book 21 times the size of a normal chess opening.
So this really solves one of the biggest problems as well, which is that the highest levels of the game are now increasingly dominated by computer algorithms. It does seem to have taken some of the magic out of the game of chess. But David's redesign of chess and your implementation has also attempted to solve that problem as well, to add maybe a bit of a human element back into the game.
Okay, so yeah, you might say that the magic is lost. Someone else might say that computers have helped us to make discoveries about the game or answer questions that would have been out of our reach. The strength that the computer has comes from analyzing huge numbers of positions very quickly, right? But the ability of the computer is limited by how many future positions it needs to analyze to select the best one. So in chess, the numbers get pretty big pretty quickly. In chess, for the first move, there's almost 200,000 ways that those first four moves can go. But with Chess 2, those numbers are actually a lot larger. In the most extreme example, if the Reaper versus Reaper matchup is selected, then there's actually, for the first same four moves, over 250 million possibilities that the way can go in the first four moves alone. That really limits the ability of the computer to select the best move, because it can't see very far into the future. So additionally, Chess 2 adds a mechanic called dueling, which emphasizes adaptation and reading the opponent's tendencies. So rather than just playing the board, you're also playing your opponent.
Chess 2, it really is quite a radical departure from a game that many people have grown up with, have presumed to be, well, perfect. But how do you ensure that you have created a balanced game? Is it possible that there's an as-yet undiscovered glitch or possibly an exploit in the rules that gives one army an unfair advantage against the other five?
Right, that's a very good question that I also had originally, but it actually kind of misses the point. Because balance is not the main goal. In the end, we want a game that's fun and interesting and has longevity. Let me give you an example of this. So Rock, Paper, Scissors is a game that's actually more balanced than chess because there's no first move advantage. But a lot of people wouldn't say that that's a very interesting game just because it's balanced, right? So the interesting parts of chess actually come from imbalanced positions, right? A player may exchange material for tempo or developments, right? And it's in that imbalance, and adapting your strategy to the current imbalance and asymmetry, is what's interesting about positional play. So we strive to create a game that is imbalanced and therefore becomes more interesting and hopefully will be fun and last for a very long time.
Chess 2 will shortly be available on the Ouya console. In case you don't know, that is the Android-based independent developer-friendly games console. In the meantime, you can get links to Zach's work-in-progress blog and the rules of Chess 2 via our show notes on poddelusion.co.uk.
And finally on this week's show, we look forward to next month, when comedian Izzy Lawrence will be performing a short run of shows on the Camden Fringe Festival in London. To sort of tell us more, here's Izzy.
Hello, Pod Delusion. Izzy Lawrence here. Who? Exactly. I'm here to talk to you about success. Now, you're academic people, you like to know the meaning of things. So, we've got the word suck, meaning suck, which can be quite good. And we've got cess, meaning cesspit. Not so good. Suck, cesspit. Not even on a subreddit forum somewhere is that popular. I'm not particularly successful myself. I did geography at university for the same reason anybody does geography at university. Fancied my teacher. Got to fancy your geography teacher. haven't you? What with their beards and their tits. But, you know, it's a science degree. You know, it is a science. Shut up, yeah. I know it's mud and the causes of mud. Advanced colouring in. Hey, Mr. Employer, I can drop an orange in a river. Time it. There is no particular kudos that comes with doing a degree in geography, nor with being a comedian. A lot of people look at me very oddly when I tell them that. Nor with being a sceptic. In fact, I'm a bit of a failure as a sceptic anyway. I've got no success there. Unless you count... You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to my pantry. As proof. But as a sceptic myself, I'm rubbish. I got taken along to a medium. We were going to debunk this medium. She, you know, she's a tarot card reader and she did ghost stuff and that sort of thing. And we sat in on a seance she was holding. And there were four other people there who are true believers, like proper believers. And I was there with another sceptic who was just completely focused on the infrared cameras and the recording equipment. We're going to catch it in the act, was the idea. I didn't think we were, because I didn't think she was going to do anything, because she spent the entire time going, I don't know if the ghosts will come out, you see. I don't think they're going to come out if you're here, because you don't believe. And your energy is the wrong sort of energy. And other BS. So I found myself in this room with four true believers all wishing to hear something, a panicking medium, a skeptic just constantly looking, busy monitoring everything, and you're there in the complete dark. How do you not tap something? How do you not do that? How do you not just go, that's a ghost? Ah! The screaming, it was amazing. Not very successful as a skeptic rationalist. No. If you want to contribute to my success as a comedian, hey, links, slick. I'm on from the 7th to the 11th of August. That's Wednesday the 7th to Sunday the 11th of August. I'm on at 8 p.m. at the Camden Head on Camden High Street. You can get your tickets from thecamdenfringe.com or by clicking the link on izzy.com. That is ISZI.com. Other than that, it's been absolutely lovely, lovely being here, and I hope you have success in everything that you do. Oh, I think my kitten just farted. Oh, that's nasty.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do remember, I really want to get a new job, so if you want to employ me, you can find my CV at poddelusion.co.uk. I assure you I've got loads of skills, like using loads of really big words. That's what I can do a lot of. Big words. And all that clever stuff. Also on our website, you can listen to nearly 4 years' worth of podcast archives and follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook if you're into those sorts of things. Whilst you're on our website, do remember you can subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all the donations as they help us keep paying the server bills and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Kate Russell, Hayley Johnson, Adam Jacobs, Liz Luckendorf, Emma Shields, Izzy Lawrence, Salim Fadley, and me, James O'Malley. With additional editing by Liz. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Plains of Austin, Texas, where the local farmers are making up for their lack of demand in their tobacco crops by meeting the new consumer demand in hummus through planting chickpeas. I'm joined by Southern Stereotype, Beauregard J. Hattenweiler III, local farmer. Good afternoon, Beauregard.
I'll be hog-tied to the lynching post if it ain't sure a swell thing to meet y'all.
Yeah, can you just tone it down a bit? There are stereotypes and they're just plain insulting.
Right. Howdy.
So, the demand for tobacco plants is dropping considerably.
Sure enough, but the nation's gone stir-crazy over hummus, and we can't grow enough chickpeas to satisfy demand, so we've moved all our farming across to healthier alternatives.
I see, because traditionally you've been about a very different sort of crop.
Well, not anymore. We're really embracing a new vegetarian lifestyle out here. We swap cattle for buffalo mozzarella, and I'm particularly proud of our corn on the cob.
I see. So, all this land I'm surveying, it's arable.
It's not arable at all, son. My family really love it.
No, no, arable, not horrible.
I'm sorry there, minor cultural misunderstanding. Yep, we're planning to farm the whole spread. Well, low cholesterol spread.
And do you think that I have what it takes to become a ranch hand?
Sorry, son, I don't think you're tofu enough.
I see, yeah. So, do you still have problems with rustling?
Not since we swapped the crisp packets for the hemp knapsacks.
Yeah, Beauregard, thanks for speaking to us today about your new vegetarian lifestyle. It's been great to meet you.
Oh, don't say meat. Please don't say meat. I'd kill for just one more burger, but if my wife catches me with red meat again, I'll be in for a nut roast.
Oh, nonsense. You'll keep it together. I'd stake my reputation on it.
Steak? Oh, good God. I'm coming for you, Daisy.
And as the farmer sprints off with a hungered look in his eye, you can only assume that he isn't going searching for something to dip in his hummus. What a pitter.